know I love Fridays because that means it's our week in review, beginning with elections during a pandemic. A WBUR poll this week shows that 4 in 10 Bay Staters plan to vote by mail. But if President Trump hinders mail-in voting by blocking funding and reducing capacity, how will the election work? Well, as he told Fox Business, not well.
Now, they need that money in order to have the post office work so it can take all of these millions and millions of ballots. Now, in the meantime, they aren't getting there. By the way, those are just two items. But if they don't get those two items, that means you can't have universal mail-in voting because they're not equipped to have it.
All the while, tensions grow for parents, teachers, students, administrators on the fall's big question. In person at school or not? Here's Boston Public Schools Superintendent Brenda Caselius.
We are anticipating to be able to make this decision rather soon, but I do understand the uncertainty. There is an urgency. We do know that they want to plan. Teachers want to know and principals want to know. We are attempting to make this decision as just as soon as possible as we can.
Joe Biden chooses history. Kamala Harris is now the first Black woman and first Asian American vice presidential candidate for a major party.
Joe, I'm so proud to stand with you. And I do so mindful of all the heroic and ambitious women before me whose sacrifice, determination, and resilience makes my presence here today even possible.
Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren, another serious candidate for the job, says Harris, quote, will be a great partner to Biden in making our government a powerful force for good in the fight for social, racial, and economic justice, end quote. It is all on the table this hour. Local and national politics, schools, and coronavirus. Pull up a chair. Tell us what you think. We're at 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. Let's turn to our panelists. Joining us now on the line is Renee Landers, professor of law and director of the health law concentration at Suffolk University. Renee, welcome back.
Thank you very much, Tiziana. It's nice to be here.
Also with us is Ed Lyons. He's a Massachusetts Republican activist and political writer. Ed, welcome back to you as well.
Thanks. Good to be here.
So I want to start with the post office, where we know two sets of things are going on. First, the president threatened yesterday and then walked back the threat to block two pieces of funding for the post office in the next stimulus package, saying explicitly that he wanted to hinder mail-in voting. Then there's a host of steps his newly appointed postmaster general, who is a former large donor, Louis DeJoy, that he has taken to curb overtime, remove sorting machines from post offices, allow mail that's due to be delivered on a certain day to sit until the next day against common practice. What's going on, Renee?
I think that there is a deliberate sabotaging of a really critical government agency. The post office, the authority for Congress to create a post office is in the Constitution of the United States. So it is not really one of those optional government services. It also has a leveling influence for the people, allows communication broadly and everyone to participate at a reasonable cost in communicating with people around the country, within their own communities, and around the world. So I think it strikes me as a deliberate attempt to undermine that very basic flow of commerce in the country.
So Ed, let's talk about some numbers, because a May Pew Research poll found that 91% of Americans had a favorable view of the Postal Service. So is this a smart move to attack something that is so widely popular, especially as we hear more and more stories of people not getting medications that they needed or other important things in the mail?
No, but it's probably smart for Trump, since he's really just trying to appeal to his base, who are Republicans, and most Republicans have been skeptical about the size and cost of the post office as a federal institution. And the post office has been suffering because its business model, if you want to describe it that way, has not worked in a while in terms of all the e-cards and online bills. Online banking has really reduced a lot of the revenue the post office has taken in. So the post office seems kind of shaky, and Republicans for years have smelled the chance to finally curtail or kill off something that the federal government does. So I think that desire to deprecate the post office has crashed into a presidential campaign that sees voting by mail as the end of its power. So I do think those two things have produced this nightmarish result where an institution that really does a lot of good things to the public has become part of presidential politics. And it is unfortunate because we now need the post office to assist us in voting by mail. So I think we've unfortunately combining our election problems with Trump's partisan desires, and therefore we have this disaster.
So, Ed, are you saying that if we weren't doing mail-in voting, we would still be seeing this level of sort of aggressive change in that the administration is making in the post office?
No, because they're purely tactical. They probably don't like the post office very, very much. Republicans don't like the post office a lot. But I don't think it would just be on the agenda. I think that Republicans have been looking to sort of like curtail the post office for years. There have been discussions about a bailout or not a bailout. The post office has revenue problems for a long time, but it would not have reached the forefront if it was not part of the election process.
Renee, I heard you wanted to jump in.
Right. I also wanted to add one other factor in the post office's troubles. And that is that Congress has required the Postal Service to account in its, economic calculations and in its financial statements for the pension liabilities for the postal workers. And, you know, in theory, that's not a bad job, not a bad thing to require. But no other company in the United States is required to do that. So it does put the Postal Service at a disadvantage with some of the other private companies that are, you know, competing, if you will, in that space for, delivering packages and delivering communications. So for a long time, the playing field has not been level for the Postal Service. And then the heightened relevance of the Postal Service in the current election environment has brought the challenges to the fore.
So Deval Patrick was speaking to WBUR about the November election and this idea of the Postal Service not getting the funding that Democrats say it needs to carry out mail-in voting. Here he is.
More and more, it's apparent that Republicans don't believe they could win a fair fight. And what Joe Biden and Kamala Harris, and I think all patriotic Americans want, is a fair fight. Let's have a contest of ideas.
And I want to zone in on this idea of the contest that is now in front of us and our participation in that in Massachusetts. And listeners, call and join this conversation. We've talked mail-in voting on the show before. How are you feeling about mail-in voting? Do you want to mail that ballot? Are you thinking about early voting, whether in person or by mail? Are you feeling confident in our election? So at a new WBUR poll found that Massachusetts residents do mostly have faith in the integrity of the system. 4 in 10 voters here plan to vote by mail. But there is a difference. Supporters of President Trump are more skeptical of it than Biden supporters are. Has it always been the case that Republicans are more skeptical of mail-in voting than Democrats? Or is this a new split?
It depends how you frame it. We're all suffering from partisan framing and the information diets that we're consuming. So there are plenty of Republicans who have voted by absentee for years, but they did not view that as a threat because no one told them that it was. So Republicans now believe overwhelmingly in the fact that they have to get to the polls in order for their vote to be counted because they're constantly being lied to that it's not possible to be able to vote by mail. Although, to be honest, this is how the extremes are getting in the way of a good debate here, that our state is not really ready for taking in all these mail-in votes. We've done absentee ballots, but doing huge amounts of ballots by mail is an administrative thing that I don't really think we're ready for. And I have no confidence in the fact that we're going to be able to process all these ballots in a way that is consistent with our values. So I'm concerned about the mechanics of getting it done. I believe it can be done. But unlike states that have had mail-in voting for years, we just don't have the processes or the resources to be able to do it properly. So I'm very concerned about what might happen.
Renee, do you share Ed's concern about our capacity to process mail-in voting here? We talked to Secretary of State Galvin recently. He said, yeah, there are risks, but he believes we're going to get it done.
I tend to agree with Secretary Galvin. I think we could get it done, but I think that it requires attention and it requires resources so that it actually can be done, so that people can receive their mail-in ballots and that there is an opportunity to return them. I'm reminded of how the Supreme Judicial Court lowered the signature requirements for some of the ballot initiatives and for candidates to appear on the ballot. There might have to be some extending of the deadlines for returning mail-in ballots, especially given the trouble with the Postal Service, so that there's a grace period after Election Day where the ballots can still be delivered to the local election officials and counted in the final tally of the votes. I mean, I think we should be thinking ahead to solutions like that to make it a much more reliable and fair process.
SJC also excoriated Galvin for how technologically backward he was in language they've never used before about a government agency, how awful he has been about delivering a system that respects our technological abilities and our civic values. I think their laceration of his technological progress in those decisions makes me nervous about this election.
Well, and this exchange makes me nervous about this election. And I don't mean that like I don't want you two to say these things. But if we are feeling this level of angst about a strategy that our state has gone all in on and that at least 4 in 10 voters are intending to use for a free and fair election, does that really put us on unstable ground?
Yes.
Renee?
I think there's enough time between now and, let's say, November, let's take the primary out of it, but between now and November to get some of the systems in place that can make it possible to have an effective election process.
All right, so before we go to a break, I want to go back to a different executive action, which is the eternity ago of the weekend, which just now feels like another year, when the president signed executive memoranda and an executive order for 4 different stimuli actions around unemployment, student loans, evictions, et cetera, to try to provide some more pandemic relief. It's been widely criticized this week as political gimmick, or it's not going to work, or it requires states to spend money they can't afford to spend. Is it unrealistic stuff, or given that Congress did, in fact, adjourned this week without getting anything done, did he have to do it, Ed?
No.
Okay.
We have a Congress and they have to solve problems, and we can't have a president violate the Constitution and constitutional norms in order to get the result that he wants. Everything about it is wrong. Even his apologists in Congress said that it was wrong. And the states, Governor Baker said that it'll be very difficult complying with the consequences of such a thing. It's an example of the fact that the president does not really respect the way our system of government works. And that ongoing belief is going to have terrible consequences for us between now and January 21st.
Renee, let's listen to what Governor Baker said here, and then I'll turn to you. Here is Governor Baker. This is him responding to the president's executive memoranda that would use FEMA funds to help stopgap unemployment payments.
We believe it needs to be done through a separate appropriation, not by taking money from FEMA, which is how we, the states, are planning to get reimbursed, as we expected and anticipated we would, for the expenses that we incurred under the emergency orders to deal with COVID in March, April, May, and June.
Renee, go ahead.
So I'd like to talk about that one, which is part of the pattern of this president. It's very similar to kind of the border wall, moving around the money in the Defense Department and Homeland Security that the president did to try to begin construction on the border wall in the face of a congressional refusal to appropriate the money to do it. And then the United States Supreme Court, kind of failed to wade in and say that the president had to respect the power of the purse that the Constitution allocates to the Congress. The second aspect of the weekend's executive orders was the suspension of the payroll taxes, which, as many people have pointed out, do nothing to help unemployed people because by definition, they're not paying payroll taxes because they're unemployed. But the second pernicious aspect of that was the potential it has for the longer term undermining of the funding mechanisms for Medicare and the Social Security system, two of the most effective and popular government programs. Not saying they're perfect, but those programs do a great deal to protect the ability of people in the beneficiary populations to live ordinary and dignified lives. And the president also indicated that he was thinking about making, some permanent change to the way those two programs are funded. And that would really undermine the stable economic security of the people who rely on those benefits now and who plan to rely on them in the future.
Ed, we're going to go to a break in a little less than a minute, but to Renee's last point, the president did say that if he got reelected, he'd try to get legislation passed that would make those tax breaks permanent, which would in fact then underfund Social Security and others. So just quick reaction, could he get that legislation passed?
I don't know, and I don't care. I think we're facing this massive constitutional crisis with a man who's undermining the elections and claim and will not admit, say that he will accept a loss in November. I just think imagining what he might ask to pass on January 22nd to me seems really unimportant right now. So my guess is no, he couldn't do that. But that's the farthest thing from my mind right now.
With us on the line is Renee Landers, professor of law and director of the Health Law Concentration at Suffolk University, and Ed Lyons, a Massachusetts Republican activist and political writer. And you, call us at 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. We're going to spend this segment talking about races. We'll start local, the first, the fourth, the Senate race between Markey and Kennedy, and then we'll go national. I'd like to hear what you think about any of these races. So give us a call. Ed, Renee, let's do start local. There was a thunderclap in an otherwise fairly quiet race in the first between House Ways and Means Chair Richard Neal and 31-year-old Holyoke Mayor Alex Morse. Morse was facing allegations of abusing his authority as mayor and a lecturer at UMass Amherst by having sex with students there. College Democrats organization that made the accusation themselves have been accused of doing so by an individual in the group who wanted to curry favor with Congressman Neal. How big a mess is this, Renee?
Well, I think it's a fairly big mess. As someone who teaches at a university, I think it goes without saying that having personal relationships, personal sexual relationships with students, whether they're your particular students or not, is kind of problematic. So, you know, I obviously don't know anything remotely accurate, probably, about the nature of the relationships but I think sort of presumptively that those kinds of relationships should be off the table for people who teach at universities.
I want to bring Alex Morse's voice in here. So just to clarify, in a letter first, a group said that Morse used dating apps to pursue friendships and sexual relationships with students at the University of Massachusetts in Amherst while a guest lecturer. The charges are short on specifics, but they allege that Morse abused his power for sex, made students uncomfortable. So Alex Morse spoke with WBUR's Anthony Brooks earlier this week before a report from The Intercept raised allegations about the allegations. Here he is.
I am adamant and I will not apologize for being an adult and for having consensual adult relationships with other men. I will not apologize for using gay dating apps in Western Massachusetts. And matching with folks on a consensual level. I won't allow the over-policing of my personal sex life.
You were also a lecturer at UMass Amherst. Did these relationships include students that you were teaching?
No.
And Ed, in a statement, I want to note that the Neal campaign said it had nothing to do with the story and commended the students for coming forward on their own. A person close to the Neal campaign added, quote, "We'd love to know where the story came from," end quote. Of course, you know that now there is some reporting suggesting that it was done cynically in order to curry favor, at least with the Neal campaign. How are you thinking about this? And is this an important subject to be discussing in this race? Or is this a nasty political blow that we need to take a different kind of moral look at?
You know, as usual in politics, I often say, like, it can be more than one thing. Many things can be true. I think that Alex Morse is, has a record as a politician. I don't think we need to look into his personal life to discover who that he is. We can look at other things. I know lots of people who are teachers and they say, God, hands off the students. All instructors know that. So it is a breach of ethics. That does not mean that he can't get more political power or deliver justice as a congressman, but it is a breach of ethics. I think it matters. I think the late hit is important that it came up now. I think that, you know, it reflects a division in the Democratic Party about, you know, how to judge these inter-party contests. So I think there are different dimensions that matter. I'm a Republican and I'm not voting in such primaries, but I do think that such power dynamics really matter. And so I think it's important, but I don't know how much that it matters. I view it as a symptom of other issues. I don't view it as some sort of disqualifying thing for Alex.
And Renee, there have been a number of voices raised this week talking about what is troubling about these allegations and the back and forth and where they came from, raising concerns about these showing old trope-like attitudes towards gay men and gay sex, that this is political backstabbing. No, this is actually about old-fashioned abuse of power. Actually, it's about irresponsible college journalism on behalf of the newspaper that ran the story in the first place. Is it one of those things more than the other, or is it all of the above, as Ed sort of alluded to just now?
I think I would agree with Ed that it's all of the above. And yes, it is concerning the way in which it's been alleged the allegations came forward. And so that definitely complicates the picture. But I think that the assertion that this is motivated by anti-gay bias or something, or homophobia, I don't think that that is relevant to the conversation at all. I hope that people would be having the same conversation about the allegations if it was involved heterosexual activity as well.
All right, let's go to the phones. They're lighting up. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We've got Dave on the line from Dedham. Dave, what's on your mind?
Well, two things. First of all, from the last segment, I'd ask both your guests, you guys are worried that Trump is not going to accept the results of the election. Are you? If Trump were to happen to win, would you accept those results? And also, I think in the case of all these primaries, the Republicans are moving further right and the Democrats are moving further left. And those of us in the middle, we have nowhere to go. I'm a middle guy Republican. I have nowhere to go. I don't believe in a lot of this stuff, but I know I'm not on the left either. I'm in the middle. And I think there's a lot of Democrats that feel the same way. And their party is going hard left also.
Dave, thanks for that call.
Yeah,
and we've had a couple of other independents call this week expressing really very similar sentiments. So let me turn to you, Ed and Renee, and let you address Dave's comments.
Well, I'll go first. So first of all, God bless you for being in the middle. I think people in the middle are going to save this country despite the extremes. So to answer your question, of course, I would accept the result by Donald Trump winning. I accepted him winning in 2016. I would accept him winning again. I'm confident Joe Biden would accept the losing result. Trump has been asked that over and over again and has demurred or said nothing. And he's also undermining it by talking about fraud all the time. So I'm more concerned about his refusal to accept that than anything else.
Renee, anything you want to say to Dave's call?
No, I think that is one unfortunate aspect of our political system, that the primary system has driven the parties into their more extreme formats. And it sort of used to be in the country that the general election would bring all of the major party candidates back toward the center. That doesn't entirely seem to be happening these days, just because the whole process and all of the issues have become so politicized. I mean, we can't even rely on science about how to respond to the COVID virus. So I think that says, you know, that says a great deal about how we can't, you know, just agree on sort of sensible middle of the road policies where warranted.
Now, let's zero in on another local race. And of course, we're in a different situation now because we're in the primaries. So the races are among people who are at least somewhat politically aligned versus across party. We had another sleepy race heat up with the Boston Globe causing the heat of all things. It's the race for the 4th Congressional District, where there were 8 Democratic candidates in the mix. And the Globe endorsed former Republican, now Democrat, Auchincloss, then faced significant backlash for the endorsement. Sorry, Jake Auchincloss. More was learned about his past, as residents of Newton, where he is a city councilor, reacted, as other candidates reacted. Did the Globe get it wrong? Do they have egg on their face now? Or does this just happen in a contentious race? Ed?
First, I happen to know Jake, of course. I met him during Governor Baker's transition committee meetings in 2014. He's a great citizen. Yes, the Globe blew it. I'm glad they picked him. But the problem was that because of the pandemic and because of the multi-candidate field, that there was not due diligence done on a lot of candidates. So the Globe endorsed him on incomplete information, where usually newspapers, when they're doing endorsements, have all the facts and evaluate them. But because of early voting that Bina Ben-Kachem and the opinionator of the Globe and the rest of the Ed board kind of evaluated him early in order to be able to influence the opinions of early mail-in voters before kind of all the facts to come out. So the endorsement ended up being problematic because of the timing and the lack of information. I'm happy they endorsed Jake, but I think that most people would decide that it was a mistake because the information they needed was not there.
So you talked about Bina. That's Bina Venkatraman, the Globe editorial page editor. After the endorsement, they then did an op talk with Auchincloss on their website. She pressed him about a lot of issues with his candidacy, including statements like the one that surfaced the day of his endorsement, in which he seemed to justify the burning of the Quran. Here's that exchange.
It was a stupid remark by a snarky 22-year-old trying to make a point and instead offending communities about which I care deeply. It was an attempt to make a nuanced point in a very tone-deaf way. And I would hope that instead of allowing my record to be defined by a social media post 10 years ago, it should be defined by my record of service.
Now, Renee, the exchange between the two in that interview was really remarkable because it was a grilling. And different people have had different thoughts about how well he did under fire like that. But I'm wondering if in having to do that, maybe the Globe still provided a service to the voters of the Fourth, where I live, by the way, giving them a chance to hear more from their chosen candidate on some pretty serious questions about things he said and done in the past, in addition to the fact that he switched parties now.
Well, I do think that it was a good idea because, as Ed was saying, you know, those facts had not been part of the consideration during the endorsement process. So I think the Globe did do a service to, you know, its readers, its listeners of that program to really inform people about those issues. I should say, in my own situation, I am the chair of the board of Planned Parenthood League of Massachusetts and the Planned Parenthood Action Fund, which is a separate organization, has endorsed Jesse Mermel in that race. And so I just wanted to make that disclosure. But I do think that it's not entirely irrelevant how long it's been since some of these events took place. But I think of Ralph Northam in the governor of Virginia, you know, who had some unfortunate antics when he was in medical school and college, you know, wearing blackface and that sort of thing as a gag. And I do believe that people can be allowed to grow and change. But in a crowded field like that, whether there are other candidates who don't have those issues, maybe it should be a factor.
All right. We've got a caller who wants to talk about the Morse-Neal campaign. I'm going to take that call real quick, and then we'll turn to Kennedy Markey for just a minute. We've got Brian on the line from Jamaica Plain. Brian, go ahead.
Hi. Yes, I'm from Western Massachusetts originally, Hampshire County, and I went to the University of Massachusetts Amherst, recently graduated. And I just think that it's important that Alex Morse's sexual past is not a factor in this election. If everybody involved was a consenting adult, I don't understand why this should be an issue for voters. I think he's going to do phenomenal things for Western Mass, and I plan on voting for him this September.
Brian, I suppose I should just double check. Are you volunteering for his campaign or working for his campaign in any way?
No, I'm entirely independent, but I do know Alex Morse. I've met him before, not in a sexual pretense, but he's a great guy. And if everybody involved is consenting, I do not understand why this is an issue for voters. Everybody
Brian,
involved is an
thanks.
Adult. College students are adults. They need to be treated likely and deal with the consequences of their actions.
Thanks for that call, Brian. I appreciate it. And I do, before we go to another break, want to take a couple of minutes to get to the Markey Kennedy race. And I'm going to start by a little bit of sound from their most recent debate earlier this week on WBZ TV4. And there's another one next Tuesday co-hosted by WBUR. I was reading that and thinking, we didn't co-host this week. I'm sorry. I was reading wrong. Listen, at this week's debate, Kennedy went after Markey again for the amount of time that he has spent in Massachusetts during his career.
You got to be here on our streets in communities like Chelsea and Fall River and Brockton and Springfield, listening to the concerns of our constituents. You got to take that fight nationally.
And then Markey made the case that he's doing precisely that, taking it national, casting himself as the progressive leader.
When I stood next to Bernie in 2017, introducing Medicare for All, Congressman Kennedy took 2 years to sign on to Medicare for All. That now looks like predictive of where we are right now.
So for a long time, this race was kind of cast as Kennedy's trying to run the, you know, sort of ride the tide of younger upstarts. And yet he's a Kennedy and there's not a lot of difference between the two of them. As this race has heated up, they're trying to put some significant difference between each other in terms of their policy positions, et cetera. Is it working, Renee?
It's hard for me to tell. I do think that you can, you know, I guess originally the polling showed Kennedy with a pretty strong lead in the race and with, but, and Markey has caught up. So I think maybe some of Markey's efforts to, you know, emphasize, you know, his record, his recent very progressive positions. I mean, he's always had progressive positions, but, you know, particularly the Medicare for All, the Green New Deal, those kinds of things, I think, maybe have made a difference. But I think some of Kennedy's criticisms have also, you know, gotten a little traction. I should say on this one also, this is to the day of disclosures, that in the past I have given money at various times to both of those candidates. So, but
well, it's you gave to both.
Yeah, you know, I did. Yeah, so. And I, you know, and I see them, you know, both making decent arguments. But I will say that at the end of the day, this is the conundrum that any member of Congress, any United States senator has. The challenge of staying in touch with the people and the residents in the district or the state, and the need to be in Washington to advocate on behalf of the issues and those constituencies. So, I think it's a tremendous challenge for our representatives in Congress in the United States Senate.
So, Ed, we've got a caller on this. I'll turn to our caller, and then I'll turn to you. We have Joe on the line from Hudson. Joe, go ahead.
Hello, how are you doing?
Well, thanks. Go ahead.
Yeah, so I'm a 20-year-old voter, supporter of Markey, and I would like to kind of like give a younger perspective on the Senate race. And many people, especially younger individuals, look for voices to represent us in Congress. However, I don't think it's always the younger candidate, especially in this race, where I see Ed Markey kind of sticking up for the younger progressive voice, you know, co-sponsoring for Medicare for All and Green New Deal.
So, Joe, I'll just ask you the same question I asked our last caller. Not working on his campaign?
I am not, no.
Okay, thanks for that call, Joe. And Ed, I'll give you the last word on this before we go to break, because Joe is bringing up a phenomenon that we're seeing, which is Kennedy is the younger candidate, but the youngest voters seem to be supporting Markey. Seem to be.
I want to tell Joe, I think you are awesome for being involved and passionate at 20 years old. The fact that you've chosen the old guy, now that I'm getting older and older, is increasingly awesome as I get older. And you give me great hope that one day I'll be elected to high office. So I think that the Kennedy-Markey race to me is really about who we are as a state. You know, Camelot came into play. Do we believe that anymore? Is it about experience? Is it about the new guy? Is it about legacy? Is it about resources? I think it is such a fascinating prism through which to view Massachusetts politics. I knew Joe Kennedy. He moved to my district to take the fourth district without earning it. He and I shared a Stop and Shop for a while. I had many amusing conversations with him before he became a household name. And I think the contest between him and Markey is absolutely fascinating. I think we're learning a lot about ourselves, and the fact that Markey has rallied to be competitive against him is extraordinary. So I do look forward. I'm not going to vote in that primary, of course, as Republican. I'm worried about the choice on our side, who's going to lose to the winner of that race in a couple of months. But, you know, I really admire this big debate about who we are as a state and how much does Camelot matter and what does Markey need? What does experience mean? Markey was once long ago the young upstart guy going to Congress, all kinds of ideas and passion. And now he's the senior statesman saying, no, 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 I know what's going on. So I think it's just a wonderful contest, and I look forward to seeing how it turns out.
So, Ed and Renee, just a minute on this, because we do have a presidential race now. The race is set. It's Biden-Harris versus Trump-Pence. And we know that Biden made this historic VP pick this week, tapping California Senator Kamala Harris as his running mate. As we heard at the top of the show, her selection makes her the first Black woman and first Asian-American major party vice presidential candidate in history. I don't want to spend a lot of time on this, but I do want to get from each of you, what is the most important note from the week about this choice? Renee.
I think it represents a tremendous recognition of the moment that we are in as a society and a culture, starting with what happened with George Floyd in Minnesota. That has changed the nature of the political conversation about inclusion of people of color in all ranks of the political process. And so I think that's a really important signal that the campaign, at least on the Biden side of the campaign, are listening and appreciating that cultural moment.
Renee, I got to stay with you for just a minute, because very shortly after the killing of George Floyd, you were on air with us and we were talking about the pain and the processing of that moment. At that time, did you think this day would be one of the things that came next?
Not necessarily. And I have to say that I am impressed with the staying power and the hold on the public attention that those events have sparked, because usually it's kind of a passing fancy of a few weeks here or a few days here and there. But significant players in the economy, significant players in the political process seem really to be taking a turn here and recognizing that it's been a very long time, 400 years since the slaves were first brought to this continent, 66 years since Brown versus Board of Education. This is a long time to wait for full inclusion in the American political process and in the economic rewards that the country has been able to offer to others.
So Ed, as a Republican activist with these tickets set, to you, what is the most important note about Biden's choice this week?
Dear Lord, let me tell you, as a very opinionated man, that my opinion does not matter in light of what Professor Landers has just said. What she said, I'll yield the balance of my time to her.
All right. So that, I think I really want to move us on to schools. We've had a lot of discussion over the last few weeks with guests, with callers here on Radio Boston about the tremendous anxiety that teachers, superintendents, parents, administrators, community members are feeling about how we go back to school this fall in a way that balances safety with young people's needs. School districts have to deliver a set of scenarios to the state by the end of the day today, including their preferred scenario. And we're seeing increasingly, although it's still not a huge number, increasingly districts choosing to start all remote. Renee, are we getting it right? And is there even a way to get this right at this moment in the pandemic?
I think it's very challenging. I have to say, I'm really glad that I'm not a parent with a school-aged child anymore, because I think these issues are very, very challenging to think through. I would be, I teach at a university, and the leaders of our university have been working really quite consistently and continuously since March on what the reopening plan might be for the fall, including modifications to the facilities, modifications in the way the facilities are used. I'm not getting the sense that that has taken place so much in some of these local school departments. And so that is a concern. There was a complacency about perhaps being able to return and not having to think about it too much in the fall. A second thing that I'm particularly concerned about is the nature of school facilities. Especially in the city of Boston. I think the Boston Globe, within the last year, had an article about the really poor bathroom and other kinds of hygienic facilities in many of the Boston public school buildings. As a parent, and that's sort of in normal times, right, when we're not hyper concerned about hygiene, being able to do a lot of hand washing and keep a distance from people. And so those issues are even more concerning now. And I have, maybe I have missed it, but I haven't read anything about big capital improvements effort to try to change those things that could make a return, a safe return, more possible.
Well, we do know, Renee, that the Boston Public Schools was making some of those investments, doing inspections of all of their buildings, doing some window replacement, making sure that nurses' offices had proper ventilation, looking at, I don't know if HVAC systems is exactly the right word, but we do know there's been some of that. And yet, I think there's been a big question, and Ed, I'm going to turn to you on this. I've heard criticism and big questions about whether the state is doing enough to help schools on all the complexities of this. I don't want to play two pieces of sound. This is Governor Baker speaking this week, unveiling in what seems to have been a surprise to many people, the state's new weekly town-by-town color-coded map of coronavirus risk, and saying that it should guide whether to send and how to send students back to school. Here he is.
If you're in a green or a white community, I can't imagine a good reason not to go back. Whether it's full-time or in some sort of a hybrid, because for all intents and purposes, you meet all the benchmarks that are being used across the country.
So we know that superintendents had been asking for that. We know many of them had to make decisions before those guidelines came out. We also spoke at the beginning of the week with Superintendent of Chelsea Public Schools, Almi Abeda, and her community had the highest COVID positivity rate in the state.
We have decided that we're going to do remote learning in the fall with the phase in. And for us in Chelsea, we really have to monitor the percent positivity rate before we can open schools safely.
So there she was already doing what the governor then later in the week came to say cities and districts should do, Ed. But that was on Wednesday when plans were due on Friday. Has the state given districts sufficient guidance to figure this out and do it well in a way that helps parents meet their needs too?
Yes, but I think that we've had a real failure of commentary in the past several weeks. The opinions for months have been, how do we reopen the schools because of all the justice-related issues and the variety of services that are offered to schools, particularly for low-income families? But everyone is missing the point, the fact that this isn't like restaurants. The staff is all unionized, and we won't take losses, and we see it as a whole. So the governor is correct that there are many school districts that could open in light of the test rates in their districts, but yet people aren't seeing that it is an entire system, that if someone's favorite kindergarten teacher dies in one particular district, that towns within 50 miles will give up on in-person learning because the parent support will collapse out of guilt and the unions will strike. So I don't believe that in-person schooling is possible for most of Massachusetts because we're not willing to take the losses. If a waitress dies in a restaurant, we're never going to hear about it, and the waitresses are not unionized. No one's going to decide that we can't eat out. This is entirely different. It is a set of political dynamics we have not experienced before. I don't believe it's possible. The unions are getting stronger and stronger in their demands of what they're going to tolerate, and the politics are not going to work. So yes, the governor is correct. There are many individual districts that can handle this, and perhaps there are some places in the state where a town with no cases surrounded by many other towns with no cases can open their schools in a hybrid model. It'll be okay. But there's no way the fact that we're going to be able to sustain losses of kids and teachers start getting sick, the political support for this will collapse, and most schools will go all remote by October 1st. So my kids are in school, and the school director just said, no way, we're not going anything in person until at least October 29th. That is just punting. I don't see anybody going back to school in my town until January 1st.
All right. So you both have had a lot to say on this and some really strong points. I want to actually give a caller the last word on this before we go to our hubbubs. So let's go to Elaine in Harwich. Elaine, you get last word on the schools question.
Yeah, I agree with him that starting schools in person is asking for disaster. The number one thing in the public, and especially with our children, should be safety. And you look to Israel a month ago, they opened up their schools and then they had outbreaks and they had to chaotically close them. And the head of...
Oh, Elaine, I lost you. I'm sorry, Elaine, we lost your sound. Yeah, Elaine, I'm so sorry. We lost the middle of that, but we got the first part, which is that it's about safety and about risk. And I appreciate you giving us the the final word on that. And we are hearing a lot about this risk calculus between safety and risk, and we're going to continue to talk about it, I'm confident, for the next several weeks. So Elaine, thanks for that last call. Renee, Ed, before we run out of time, I do want to leave us some space for hubbubs. Those are those brief local events or stories that caught our attention this week. Renee, why don't you go first?
Sure. I want to flag an article that was in the Boston Globe, a profile of a young baker named Alex Samaras White, who is living at his family's farm in Cohasset, Holly Hill Farm. Alec has severe dyslexia. His family has invested a lot in his education to try to allow him to be able to accommodate that dyslexia and find a path, a productive path in life, which he seems to have done because he has become a bread baker. And he has started a business during the pandemic. He sells loaves on a daily basis to local shops and through weekly subscriptions. And I just think it's a good story about the resilience of the human spirit, and also an illustration of something I was talking about a little bit earlier in this program, that there are for people who haven't been able to make this transition like Alec. There are a lot of people who the Social Security disability system tries to take account of people who can't work because of various kinds of disabilities. And the system right now is too binary. You're either totally and permanently disabled, or you can work full time and earn a living. And many people fall in that, in a category in between. And that's one of the areas for reform for our Social Security system that would help us all.
Thanks, Renee. Ed, we've got a minute left. I do want to make sure to give you a chance to go here, too. What is your hubbub?
Well, the first of the new Redline cars is going to hit the track for testing. This is a great moment. My children and I visited the model Redline car on City Hall Plaza when it was debuted. The Redline represents a significant problem for the MBTA in terms of the fires, the delays, the overcrowding, the breakdowns, the massive derailment that happened a year and a half ago that caused so many problems. The MBTA has been running around fixing things at incredible speed, shutting things down, putting in substitute service. I think it's a sign of the fact that the MBTA is actually going to fix most of the problems that frustrate our riders. And it's all going to happen while we're not paying attention. So I think the Redline card today arriving is a huge moment in terms of transportation working again in Massachusetts that nobody's paying attention to.
Well, I love you both for giving us a little bit of moment of joy and optimism there. Thank you for that. I won't do my hubbub because we're out of time, but my little hubbub will be that actually my very first day hosting Radio Boston was the Red Line derailment last year. So it's nice to see your optimism on what comes next, Ed. And that is Ed Lyons. Yep. He's a Massachusetts Republican activist and political writer. Ed, thanks.
Thank you.
And Renee Landers, professor of law and director of the health law concentration at Suffolk University. Renee, thanks to you too.
Thank you very much.